Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. You know that old joke about economists, how they always say, well, on the one hand, and then they say, but on the other? Yeah, that is kind of where we are today with this economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, the 13th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I know. You get sick and tired of the economic doom and gloom we are sometimes obliged to deliver. We know because you tell us. Texts and tweets, we get them. It's no fun for us either, you know. So it is my great pleasure to be able to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that for the first time in 21 weeks, less than a million people lost their jobs last week. Now, that is fundamentally a ridiculous thing to be celebrating, but it's a big deal that that number is slowly going down. And the number of people on any kind of government unemployment benefit has fallen below 30 million. Again, a huge number, but in the coronavirus context, better. The question is, better than what? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
If my inbox could talk, and yeah, there is an app for that, my emails this morning would have been shouting, welcome news and job market improvement. Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics had a few of those words.
Well, it's progress.
But
that's a long way from anything anyone would consider to be a good economy.
New jobless claims are still 50% higher than the worst week of the Great Recession.
This is off the charts kind of bad. I mean, we're digging out, but we got a long way before we get out. We don't know how long many of these unemployed folks will remain unemployed and not get back to work.
Keep in mind, people usually stay on unemployment until their old job calls them back or they get a new job. Dave Gilbertson tracks this at workforce management firm Kronos, which, note, is a marketplace underwriter.
We're still seeing this phase of furloughed employees being called back into work. We're not seeing an indicator yet that net new employees are being hired.
Americans' unemployment checks have shrunk by $600 a week since federal pandemic benefits expired in late July. Jessica Oyanagi is a freelance photographer in Hawaii. She's been on unemployment since March.
We kind of burn through our savings because we don't have a lot.
She says that extra $600
is kind of what has made the big difference, right, for our family just being able to like keep up with rent and essentials and bills and things like that.
Now the family will be scrambling to make ends meet with her $263 a week in unemployment, plus her husband's pay as an essential worker. A recent study published by the National Bureau of Economic Research estimates that losing the $600 payments will cut local consumer spending by 44%. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We got a new report from the National League of Cities today about the financial situation of those cities. Suffice it to say, not great. Broadly speaking, all major sources of tax revenues are down, and 90% of the cities surveyed said next year's financial situation is looking even worse. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more now on what's at stake at the local level.
The kind of services that cities fund are services that people deal with every day.
Police, fire, garbage, road paving, water and sewer.
John Cranley is the mayor of Cincinnati. His city relies heavily on income tax revenue, which has fallen with unemployment spiking. Cranley says the city's had to borrow more to avoid layoffs in those services. It's taking other measures, too.
We're not replacing retirees to avoid layoffs, and just over time that diminishes the quality and the quantity of the service.
Cities also rely on sales tax revenue, and consumers have been spending less. Christiana McFarland with the National League of Cities is the report's co-author. She says property tax revenue is likely to drop too, but that drop-off likely won't be felt until next year. As a result, cities are anticipating more cuts.
Particularly when it comes to their municipal workforce, additional services, pulling back on capital and infrastructure projects. And these are all things that have broader effects on the national economy and economic recovery.
And when big projects are cut back or delayed, it means people won't have services or infrastructure they need over a longer stretch of time, says Tracy Gordon at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center.
It makes perfect sense to not build a new bridge in the middle of a recession, like to, you know, hold back on that. But if you hold back on that year after year, you don't have that bridge.
And that affects a lot of people. A report last year from the University of Michigan found that 84% of the U.S. population lives in urban areas. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Among the sticking points in Congress over another economic support package is aid to states and cities. A big sticking point it is, too. You can cancel your Google alert, by the way, for any kind of report on that economic deal. The House is already out. The Senate went home today, back around Labor Day. As we said mere moments ago, almost a million people lost their jobs in this economy in the week that ended last Saturday. Traders on Wall Street, they had the sads today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Recreational Equipment Incorporated, REI to most of us, the outdoor gear people, was set to move employees into its brand new Seattle area headquarters this summer. Well, the company told people yesterday that is not happening anymore. And in fact, they are looking for somebody to buy their sprawling and now empty property. And that kind of does raise a question. Does it even make sense anymore for a company to have a headquarters? Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
REI is a retail co-op. Members get discounts on gear for hiking, camping, biking, outdoorsy stuff. REI executive Ben Steele says the company's identity informed the new HQ.
We really sought to build a space that was, I think, very representative of the brand and ethos of the co-op.
The property features outdoor staircases, native plants, and skylights. But the 1,200 employees who were getting ready to move in now won't enjoy that space. Steele says REI will instead lease smaller offices around Seattle and allow employees to work remotely. Sarah Sutton is CEO of FlexJobs. She's not surprised REI's pulling the plug on a new headquarters.
They're identifying there are a lot of opportunities for their employees to work from home remotely and still maintain productivity even if they can't be in the office.
But retail employees, of course, still have to be in REI stores to help customers. Callie Williams-Yost of the Flex Strategy Group says companies considering their workspace strategy should avoid tilting too much in one direction.
I think there is this tendency to think, oh, we can save all this money. Let's get rid of all of our workspace. When really, it's about optimizing it.
She says employees want a hybrid approach, some time at the headquarters, some time in their kitchen. And about that new campus, REI's Ben Steele says the company hasn't lined up a buyer yet, but he's not concerned about the money already spent.
We think it's a very attractive space. We expect to get, you know, premium pricing.
At the same time, fewer companies are looking for office space, so selling it could be tougher than it was just 6 months ago. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
So about that office space, more companies are deciding, as you have heard, that their people can work from home indefinitely, and some of them are paying remote work stipends. Google and Twitter, Shopify among them. Stipends that will let employees buy themselves things they need to recreate the office at home. And as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, what those things are kind of varies from company to company.
Sean Page already worked from home when the pandemic started. His employer, tech company Webflow, paid him a home office stipend of $250 a month, then upped it by 50%. Page has used the money to buy a chair and wellness apps and
my charger crapped out just because I've been, you know, using my laptop nonstop. And so it was really nice having that remote stipend to kind of cover that cost when that occurred.
More companies are following Webflow's lead. Peter Capelli, director of the Center for Human Resources at the Wharton School, says that's the kind of thing potential employees look for.
They check what we know about this company and what they've done and how they've treated their employees before. So it's kind of an investment in future recruiting.
There are legal reasons for companies to spend this money, says Bradford Bell, a human resources professor at Cornell.
You certainly have issues around, you know, employee health and wellness.
So an ergonomic chair might make sense. And
they're dealing with sensitive information and data. Sometimes they might need file cabinets that lock, for example.
These stipends can provide the perks that a lot of workplaces offer. The cloud computing company Box in Redwood City, California, fed workers breakfast, lunch, and snacks. Since lockdown, they got $600 in stipends. Chief People Officer Jessica Swank says the company isn't trying to recreate its office experience.
We recognize that we can't duplicate it one-to-one.
She says she hopes the stipends make it more comfortable for employees until they get back to the office, whenever that is. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Generation Z, which is, give or take, people born between 1995 and 2010, has been in the headlines quite a bit the past couple of years. Think the political activism from the students in Parkland, Florida. A lot of the young Black Lives Matter protesters as well. And those TikTok teenagers who messed with the Trump campaign rally in Tulsa, if you remember that. The older members of Gen Z have already started entering the workforce. Some of the younger ones, too, though, are starting companies.
My name is Michaela Ulmer. I am 15 years old, and I'm a student, a Bee ambassador, a social entrepreneur, and an author. My company actually started as a lemonade stand in Austin, Texas. I was in kindergarten, and I signed up for Lemonade Day, which is a business fair here in Austin, and I was trying to figure out what product to create and sell. I got stung by two bees and ended up doing some research and learning that they're super important to our ecosystem and food supply, but that they're also dying. And so I decided to do a lemonade stand to help save them by sweetening my lemonade with honey and donating a portion of the profits I made to organizations that help the bees. I sold each year, maybe two or three times a year, just because I enjoyed selling out of the product. And when I was around 8, a local pizza shop contacted me and said, hey, if you can find a way to bottle your product, we'd like to carry it in our store. And over the next year, more stores in Austin and eventually Whole Foods asked to carry the product. After Whole Foods asked, we got a offer from the African American Chamber of Commerce to audition for Shark Tank. And so fast forward, it started off with some local stores in Austin, Whole Foods, but it quickly grew to Fresh Market and Cost Plus World Market and different like markets around the country. 2019 was our 10-year anniversary. So we were celebrating 10 years in business. And currently my mission is to make a measurable impact on saving bees, but also teach kid entrepreneurship and social entrepreneurship. I don't think that there's a limit or any particular guidelines on who can become an entrepreneur or who can start a company. The perception is that you have to be, or not you have to be, but if you want to be successful, there's like a certain race or gender or age that you need to be if you want to make it big or like be successful or grow your company. But me and so many other kid entrepreneurs, Black-owned businesses are proving that that's not the case. And that if you have a good idea, good timing, a good team, if you can network, you can do it as well.
You can read an excerpt from Michaela's new book, which is called Be Fearless, by the way. It's spelled B-E-E, in case she raises money for bee conservation, right? Get it? It's at marketplace.org. And if you've got an entrepreneurial kid out there wanting to learn about money and finance, we've got a podcast for you. It's called Million Bazillion. Check it out. Coming up.
They would give little side remarks, kind of look at her weird, kind of like the, oh, okay, that's interesting.
Well, that's a little judgy, don't you think? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials down 80 points today, 80 points, almost 0.3%, finished at 27,896. The NASDAQ added 30 points, 0.2%, 11,042. The S&P 500 gave up about 7 points, 0.2%, 33.73. The pandemic is causing more pain to households with children than to those without. That's the conclusion of a new survey out today from the New York Fed. About 27% of households without kids canceled or postponed a major purchase because of the virus. That's compared to more than 41% of households with kids that did. 1 in 5 households without children dipped into savings to make ends meet. 1 in 4 households with kids did that. All of those stats, by the way, get even worse for single-parent households. Bond prices, they fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note bumping up a bit lately, 0.71%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Claire Babineau-Fontenot is the CEO of Feeding America. That's a network of more than 200 food banks across the country. It's the biggest hunger relief organization that we have at a time when food need is growing fast. She is also, as a result, becoming something of a regular guest on this program as this pandemic wears on. Claire Babineau-Fontenot, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you for having me back.
Because we called you because obviously you're busy. We spoke to you a number of months ago as this thing was just starting and you were busy. I imagine 5.5 something months into this, you are now busier still.
This is true. Unfortunately, there continues to be a whole lot of need out there. There is definitely a food crisis that has come along with the health crisis.
Do you have what you need? Do you have volunteers? We talked about that last time. Do you have food supply that you can distribute?
Well, maybe the best way to respond to that question, I guess the short answer is not everything that we need. So In normal times, we provide meals and other services for people facing hunger to the tune of about 40 million people. Since this pandemic, our estimates are that the number of food insecure people in the country are going to hopefully peak at 54 million people across the U.S. who will be food insecure. So we're seeing significant increases in demand, and we're continuing to have some pressure in terms of supply. So we just completed a study, and what we were able to determine is we project that over the course of the next 12 months, there's going to be a gap of about 8 billion meals. That includes all of the interventions we've already had, and we simply can't do this alone.
Those numbers are stunning, 54 million people and 8 billion meals. What are you watching as you try to analyze the trend in figuring out how bad and it might get for you?
Yeah. So we're looking at what happened in previous recessions and financial crises. We're also looking at current trends by virtue of a survey that we do of our food banks. For instance, about 40% of the people who are coming to us for help are people who have never before relied upon the charitable food system. So we use that data. As I said, it's really challenging right now. And that's the bad news. The good news is there are things we can do to make things better.
Yeah, hit me with those, because after those bad numbers, we could use some good news.
Great. Well, I would ask that there continue to be some of the generosity that we've seen throughout this whole pandemic to provide donations of food, funds, and volunteer time. But even with all of that, that's not going to solve the whole challenge either. So we're asking for people to reach out to members of Congress. And right now, let's urge them to get back to the table and to prioritize the needs of the most vulnerable members of our society. They can make additional investments in the federal nutrition programs. We know from past financial crises that for every $1 invested in those federal nutrition programs, the return on to the economy is $1.70. It's one of the most stimulative things that they can do. So it's good for people and it's good for the economy at large. I mentioned it a couple of times. I want to just address it very directly. The outpouring of support that we've received from industry, from farmers, from the government, there have been some policy interventions that have been very helpful, and from the American public, it is unprecedented. The need is also unprecedented. But we want to thank everyone who's made investments in our work.
Well, Claire, thank you for your time. Claire Babineau-Fontenot is the CEO of Feeding America. Claire, thanks a bunch.
Thank you, sir.
If you stop to think about it, What we buy and how we choose to buy it says something about who we are and what matters to us. That's why Savannah Ward, she lives in Columbus, Ohio. That's why she buys almost everything secondhand. Kitchen utensils, couches, bathing suits, her cat's litter box. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra has this latest installment of our series, How We Shop.
It's early March of 2020, and Savannah Ward is browsing the plastic aisle at a local thrift store.
As you can see, like, you can literally buy anything you want here. Like, here is an ice tray. Here is a pastry gun. These are, you know, like, you would pay a lot of money at Bed Bath & Beyond for this.
Savannah's 26. She teaches English as a second language at a high school in Columbus. And she used to hate thrift stores. When she was a kid, her mom would buy almost everything secondhand. People at church would ask her mom, "Where'd you get that purse?" And she would tell them, proudly.
They would give little side remarks, kind of look at her weird, kind of like the, "Oh, okay, that's interesting.
Savannah remembers when she was a teenager and needed sports gear, like knee pads and soccer cleats, and her mom wanted to get them at a thrift store.
I remember getting in a huge fight and being like, "Mom, why can't you just let me buy new stuff? Like, why can't you?"
Yeah, she would get a little, she got a little upset about it. That's her mom, Chris Ann, who says she gets a thrill hunting for treasures at thrift stores. But it's also about saving money, something she says was lost on Savannah at the time.
You know, kids, when they're younger, they always want the best and this and that, and it doesn't last very long, and they don't understand the value of a dollar, but as adults, we do. But then when she had to pay for her own clothes, it was a different story, and she was like, I know what my mom was doing.
In high school, Savannah couldn't afford what all her friends were wearing, Marc Jacobs and J. Crew and Chanel, so she started thrifting, in secret. Like, she found a Chanel necklace on eBay, possibly a fake, for $6.
And no one knew that I was hunting on eBay and I was bidding, you know, like all night just so I could fit in with the crowd.
So that's how Savannah got hooked on thrift shopping, because of high school peer pressure. Then in college, during a women's studies class, Savannah's professor asked her and the other students to look at the tags on their shirts.
And, you know, every single person, it said made in Bangladesh or made in China.
And she learned they're often made under sweatshop conditions, with low wages and safety hazards that lead to fires and building collapses, like the one at a Bangladesh clothing factory in 2013 that killed more than 1,100 people.
I never made the connection there. I didn't really think about the people behind each garment. And that was just a really eye-opening class and really eye-opening lesson for me.
She later learned about the environmental impact of fast fashion, how much clothing ends up in landfills. And so she started shopping almost exclusively secondhand, this time as a statement of her values. And then she turned it into a side business, started reselling thrifted earrings and mirrors and high-waisted shorts on Instagram.
The first day that I decided to do it, I think I posted like 10 items that I thrifted, and they all sold out.
Last summer, she made $10,000 on this. So that's where things stood when I talked to Savannah in March. But the past few months have changed her. Because of the virus, she's staying away from thrift stores for now. She doesn't want to put herself or anyone else at risk. She had some items in storage, and they've sold out in seconds. She's also been changed by the protests around racial justice and economic inequality. She's gotten a lot of messages on Instagram recently saying it's not ethical for her to shop at thrift stores because she's taking items away from people who can't afford to buy them somewhere else. And then she's reselling them at a markup.
Which put me in a really uncomfortable position, but also allowed me to grow and, you know, think more deeply about these issues.
She thinks they have a point. But she also talked to thrift stores and says they told her they have more donations than sales and end up throwing stuff away. So yeah, she's torn.
Does me helping the environment mean I am taking away from people in poverty? I honestly will never know. The thrift stores say no, but people on Instagram say yes. So
she's going to be more selective about what she resells from thrift stores. Maybe vases and vintage decor are okay, but she'll stay away from necessities like clothing. She's trying to shop with her values in mind. But sometimes that's hard to pull off. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. We did a story a couple of months ago. I think it was Sabri, I'm not really sure, about New York real estate and the coronavirus and what might happen to one of the most expensive real estate cities in the world. Here's a data point from the real estate brokerage Douglas Elliman. The number of apartments for rent in the city has more than doubled over the past year to a bit more than 13,000. The number of new leases signed is down 23%. That is July data, if you're curious. And in accordance with the well-trod dictates of supply and demand, rents are down about 10% as well. All right, we are out of here, but first, a moment of economic context in which, honestly, I ask for your help. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the big mortgage giants, have announced a new fee for home refinancing, something called an adverse market refinance fee. At a time of record low rates, it has to be pointed out. This fee would add 0.5% to most refis starting next month, making them, one industry group says, $1,400 more expensive per refinancing. So here is where I need your help. Adverse market fee? What even is that? All right, we're done. Amir Bibawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.